This week on Writers, Inc.
I listen to the same song on repeat until I'm done with the scene.
Oh.
And the song changes based on what scene I'm writing.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories. All have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
They tell me I'm J. Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I need some parenting advice from you guys. And I kind of touched on this in our text chain.
I've been waiting my whole life to give this. Go ahead.
says the guy who doesn't have kids.
I have no kids. Here's my advice.
My daughter is 8. And she's been struggling with reading for a while now. And we finally got her to the point where she's, you know, like she seems like she enjoys it. Like we always have to twist her arm and get her to do it. But like we read to her every night. She reads to us every night. But one of the other things I've been encouraging probably over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 months or so is just making up stories, you know, like storytelling. So like if she doesn't want to read a book that night, like that's her choice. She can either read a book with us or she can tell us a story. And then I record those and transcribe them and staple them, you know, so she's got like a little library of stories that she's made up over the last, you know, 6 months or whatever it's been. So I encourage that creative aspect as much as I possibly can. Then the other day we got a frantic text from one of the parents over at my daughter's school. And she basically said, "I'm so sorry to hear what happened to so-and-so." And my wife was like, "I'm not sure what this is about. I don't know who so-and-so is." And like, she thought maybe this person had texted, you know, like the wrong person. But then like 20 minutes later, she got another one and then another one.
Oh,
and
no.
Then we got a phone call from my daughter's teacher. So apparently my daughter told a story to some of her classmates at recess about a friend of hers who went to Disney World with her grandma and died in a tsunami. Now, as far as I know, you can't get hit by a tsunami at Disney World because Orlando's kind of in the middle of the state. But like she told this story convincingly enough where the kids went home and told their parents. And, you know, like this kind of spread from, you know, one to the next to the next. So my wife and I are trying to figure out how to deal with this because, you know, one side of me is like, this is great. You know, she's actually making stuff up to the point where it's believable. Like that's what I do. And I get paid well for doing it. You know, so I want to encourage that. And the other part of me is like, holy shit, we need to put a governor on this before it gets out of hand. So I'm trying to figure out how to approach her because I haven't actually talked to her specifically about this. My wife kind of did. They've had that conversation, but like I'm the one who encourages the creative stuff, you know, so I need to sit her down and, you know, tell her something. So I'm just trying to figure out a way to talk to her about it.
Listen, kid, lying is wrong unless you're writing it down and making money from it.
She needs to monetize. That's the advice.
Wow.
Seriously, like that, I've had that conversation with her. She's like, you know, like I have told her that I basically lie for a living. Like I make stuff up for a living. You know, so like
I keep thinking though, I'm like, that's how Stephen King got his start, right? But he wrote it down and sold them for like $2 or whatever. But yeah, you know.
He sounds like a smart kid. And I think you know, I'm always a big believer, at least this is how I raise my son, for better or for worse, in, you know, telling them the truth, obviously at the level that they can handle. And like, so I would probably say something like, I think it's great that you have like an imagination and that, you know, you told this story so convincingly, but it's important that, you know, a story is different from a lie in that a story is enjoyable. So maybe kind of explain that you have to bring your audience in on it at some point. Like you can't let your friends go home believing.
The difference is that the audience has to know
that's it
in advance, and then it's a story. If the audience doesn't know in advance, then it's a lie.
Or even just saying, like, you know, you can tell stories and you can, you know, have fun, you know, telling these stories to your friends, but you have to tell them
it's a story. You have to tell them it's a story.
That makes sense. I like that.
All right, now explain H.G. Wells.
Because I think kids like pick up on things. I guess that's why I've always been a big believer in the truth, like kind of letting them understand. I think that's why kids always ask why, which drives everyone crazy. But, you know, they're trying to process and understand. And so if she understands, that it's not the storytelling that's the problem. It's sort of just, well, they can't go home thinking it's the truth. Like you have to tell them. I feel like maybe that'll click for her. I
Yeah,
don't
that's
know.
something that I've honestly noticed, like, and I never really thought about it before, but little kids, like, when you read them a story or when they see something on TV, as far as they're concerned, it's true. Like they don't mentally understand that it's not true. And honestly, it brought me back to when 9/11 happened. And I don't know if you remember the news stories when 9/11 happened, but kids were, they saw the video of these planes hitting the buildings, and they saw that video repeated over and over again. And a lot of kids actually believed that, a bunch of buildings came down, because they saw that same video over and over again. So it's like it's kind of the same thing. Like you tell a kid a story, like they don't necessarily understand that it's a made up story.
Can I just say, by the way, I thought you were going a different direction with that story for a second. Like they saw that and they believed that 9/11 actually happened. I'm like, wow, they need to get JD his tinfoil hat, man.
Wow,
That
Kevin.
sounds more like what Jenna would have said.
I would not. Kevin thinks I'm a conspiracy theorist, and all I have just revealed is the dark truth of the world.
I'm the only anti-government one here, I think. The government faked 9/11.
Oh,
wow.
please
No, it
don't
didn't, Kevin.
don't
But
say that out loud.
you.
That's how you get that knock on your door at 3 o'clock in the
They can
morning.
come a knocking. They can come a knocking.
Oh my God.
So I told you my advice, by the way.
Monetize. Write them down and monetize.
Yeah, monetize it, but
Monetize.
and let her see the number. Let her see how much money it makes, and then donate every penny of it in her name to a tsunami charity. Then she learns the value of making a buck, but also not lying. So, okay, here we got the news. So, the anxiety plaguing male fiction writers, or the Kevin Tomlinson story. In reviewing recent novels about the contemporary male experience, Robert Rubsum hits on the idea that writers know they have to compete with the internet and video games for men's attention. And many writers attempt to do this by imitating those other more dopamine-inducing forms of media. Some authors stated they received direction from editors and publishers encouraging them to connect all the dots for readers to make their books easy to understand and digest. Others argue that with only about 16% of Americans reading for pleasure and many young people weary of social media, fiction should lean into what screens can't, deep immersion. Let them be a true alternative rather than a poor imitation. Also, the Kevin Tomlinson story.
Any of these thoughts ever pass through your head when you're writing a book?
Oh yeah.
No.
When I'm writing a book, they pass through my head that like I need to make this for shorter interest spans. That
Yeah,
passes through my head a lot.
I don't cater to short attention spans. They can go elsewhere. That's not my audience.
Oh
So.
no, Kevin, your books are very fast paced, and I think that I don't know. I think that
They're not short dopamine hits, though. Like it, you still have to read the whole book, and it's 350 pages plus whatever. So it's not like, now I get plenty of people who say they read it in an afternoon or whatever. But that's different from I just spent the past 3 hours, scrolling through TikTok or YouTube shorts. That's not the same hit. It is kind of, I like my stuff to be fast paced, but when you get to the end of it, you've gone on a trip. You didn't
But I
just
think that's
flip a channel.
the purpose of fast pace. I mean, I think like some of this kind of goes to the argument between like, more literary works versus, the four letter genre fiction is that,
Isn't genre 5 letters?
the elite sort of look at, genre fiction as, not as I guess satisfying, or I don't know what the right word is, and I think that sometimes you lean into that. You hear things like 1,000 word chapters, popcorn chapters, right? It's like you have to just keep eating because they're short and they're snappy. And I think that's sort of what mimics social media in a way. If you have a very short chapter that's like kind of action packed, even if it's a slower chapter, you end on the cliff note, right? It's like that reel. It takes you to the next one, which takes you to the next one, which takes you to the next one.
All right.
I
Well,
think
I'd
that.
like to change my answer.
Yeah, no,
I
I think
absolutely do this.
I always say this. I feel like this. I say this all the time, but there are different readers, right? So you have readers who want that slower paced, more challenging, more ambiguous, more immersive fiction. And then you have readers who like that fast pace, like keep me turning the pages and up all night. So I think there is a place for both.
I would be very curious to see the, you know, the levels or the on each of those, you know, those two groups. Like, is genre fiction increasing in readership? Is literary fiction decreasing? Vice versa. Based on what the story is about, we should see an increase in genre fiction, and literary should be drying up because, you know, if you're looking for that TikTok hit in a book, you're not going to find it in literary. But I'd be really curious to see that. I mean, I've been doing a lot of these things, you know, from the get-go, just not consciously. You know, like I do short chapters, you know, I do cliffhangers. I'm giving in those dopamine hits, I guess, but I never really thought of it on this level.
I like reading those kinds of books. I think there's probably a core group of readers, right? Like, I don't know that literary fiction will ever like completely dry up, because I know that like in my, you know, like personal friend group, people who prefer literary fiction, like they sort of like the slower nature of the book. Like, they like to go in and sort of meander through the story and spend, you know, weeks or months reading one book. Versus, I think, you know, us genre readers, like I like to get in a story and it have it just like reach in, grab you by the throat, and you can't let, you're just like, you will finish this. Like, I like reading those kinds of books, which is why I don't like the meandering books. So I think, I don't know, I think it's probably, you're always going to have both, but I think genre fiction is, I mean, they just interviewed Alma Katsu in Becky, oh, what's her last name? Sprater, about horror in People magazine. So I think like genre fiction is seeing a bit of a.
I think even within genre, like it's different. If you're reading. And even within specific genres, there's like literary horror and like ripping pace horror. You know, there's that fantasy that has that ripping pace, and then there are the epics that are immersive. I like reading both. I like the ones that dip into those weird subconscious side wells and immerse me in some kind of weird surrealist painting, and I'm like, what's going on? And I like the ones that rip. I like both of them, as long as they're genre.
I've got a buddy the other day who was telling me about a book, and he prefaced it by saying, it's a tough read. It was really hard to get through, but if you can get through it, it's worth it. And like, just that alone is enough for me to not want to go anywhere near it. But like, this particular person seeks those books out. Like, he wants a book that's, you know, 2,000 pages long, that has words he doesn't understand, that he's got to, you know, put down every 3 seconds to look something up or whatever. Like, some people just enjoy that. And I don't get it, but like, that group is out there, and it's a big group, you know? So,
Absolutely.
I used to be that. I don't know what happened to me. Too much TikTok,
Too much
all
TikTok.
the or the YouTube equivalent, because I don't do TikTok. All right. Well, speaking of LeVar Burton, by the way, he'll be nowhere near this relaunch of Reading Rainbow. Reading Rainbow to return with viral librarian Michael Threets as its host. Reading Rainbow is coming back after almost 20 years, with viral librarian and literacy advocate Michael Threets taking over hosting from LeVar Burton. New episodes premiere Saturdays in October on Kidzuko on YouTube, and will also stream on the Reading Rainbow website. That's fun.
That's cool.
I have to confess, I have never once watched Reading Rainbow. I know
Oh.
it's out there. I've heard it's fantastic. It's just I think it was just after my time.
Well, maybe we can get your daughter to read it, and we can, you know, engage
There
that
you go.
reading and deepen it, and she can kind of, you know, learn even more lessons about the
They can
logic
teach
of.
her how to lie like a real pro.
Wow. Kevin.
Is it geared towards a certain age group?
It's for a younger age group, and they read a book.
Probably about your daughter's age, actually.
Or maybe even she might be on the cusp of just, you know, but
I would advise going and finding all the original Reading Rainbows. They're probably on YouTube
they're
or
fun.
something with LeVar Burton. They are fun. And because they were
I
kind of one of those
remember.
things that I was past the prime for that thing too. But in fact, I think I was in my 20s or something. I have no idea. But I remember just kind of flipping around, and it would be on, and I was a Star Trek fan, so I
Reading.
gave it a shot. And it was kind of a nice little, you know, he would do like these. Like, he might go on location somewhere. Like, if the book was about, say, making, you know, I don't know, making crayons, he'd go to the crayon factory and he'd interview people, and you know, so it was nice. It was entertaining and educating.
It was cool. I enjoyed it a lot. So I'm just glad it's coming back. I think it's great. educational programming for kids, and he's going to be a great host.
Anything that gets my future customers to read, I am all over.
Yeah,
Let's do that.
absolutely. That love of reading, it's important.
Also, spending money on my books. That's what we're wanting.
Heaven.
9/11 wasn't real. All right. So, next up, the publishing industry has a gambling problem. Don't we all? Publishers are betting on blockbusters and judging writers by, quote, track or past sales, which puts extreme pressure on debuts and leaves far fewer second chances than earlier eras. Data-driven, risk-averse decisions and consolidations squeeze the mid-list, push marginalized and experimental voices aside, and send dropped authors to small presses, crowding out true newcomers. With both coverage shrinking and discovery funneled to a few big titles, readers are being spoon-fed. The piece urges rebuilding long-term author development and asks readers to look beyond their season's hottest books.
Kind of building on that story we had last week, right? I mean, we're basically covering what they used to discover a book and decide whether they want to move forward with it. And this is kind of the flip side of it. Unfortunately, everything is shrinking, and I don't know what you do about it. You know, like magazine reviews used to be a big thing. Now there's only a handful of magazines, newspapers, same thing. Television channels are more or less going away. It's all been replaced by social media, and that's more of a viral thing. You know, influencers will talk about a book if they know that it's going to get them likes and clicks. So that means somebody else has to be talking about the book, and they don't necessarily care about the book. It's all about the end result for their particular channel. So we've got to figure out how to capitalize on that. I don't know how to do it, but we need to figure it out.
Yeah. I don't have an answer either. I mean, I'm glad that I already have a mailing list. And I think, while I was at Nink, I had a lot of discussions about, there were a lot of authors who are disillusioned and basically just dropping. They're getting out. And I hate to see that. But I had a conversation with somebody at one point where I said, the truth is we're not actually in the book business or the publishing business. We're in the list building business. Like we should be aiming at like how do we build as big an audience as possible around ourselves so that, we're insulated from ups and downs in the industry. And then the industry can kind of do what it's going to do, and then you have your own private ecosystem. That's what the whole direct sales thing is really about. But you have the problem of discoverability still. But you just use whatever tricks you can to get as many people to subscribe to you as possible. It's the only solution I've come up with.
Well, honestly, one of the problems that comes up with selling direct is it's very difficult to track that. And a lot of these different systems that, there's algorithms at work in virtually every part of our lives. And there's algorithms that tell newspapers, magazines, television channels, reporters, all these people what they should be looking at. So you could be selling a ton of books, but if you're doing it through a ton of different channels, there's nothing that's actually aggregating that information. So you're selling a little here, a little here, a little here. You add it all up, it might be fantastic. But because it's so many different sources and nobody is actually tracking it, nobody knows. And if you go back 10 years ago, that was the job of BookScan, because they were kind of the only game in town. If you bought a book at Walmart, you bought it at a bookstore, you bought it on Amazon, BookScan tracked that, and they put all that information together. And that's how the other side of this industry knew what they should be talking about. But that it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I think I know that it's not a very glamorous answer, but I think that the only thing you really can do is, like I keep thinking about what Kelsea said, and like you just kind of have to make the decision that you want to do it and then just keep doing it and then just keep trying to get better and not be afraid to try new things and not be afraid of failure. And I think that if you do that, most things in business, like everything has a cycle, right? So it's like we're in a certain cycle right now, but we're not going to be in that cycle forever. And what the next cycle is going to be, nobody knows. And you can't predict it and you can't prepare for it. But the one thing you can do is just, constantly strive to make your writing and your storytelling the best that you can make it, because, everything in business is a marathon, not a sprint, and publishing is a business. And so if you just train for the marathon and keep at it, I don't remember, there's someone who said that, luck is nothing but hard work and timing. And so if you just keep working hard, the timing will eventually be there, and that's luck. And It's not glamorous, and that certainly doesn't make the marathon any easier to run. But I think that that's the only thing that you can do.
I think that's true, but I think what they're talking about, the gambling problem with traditional publishing, has made it even harder, this marathon, where if you're not successful, that shrinking mid list has been going on for a while, then they kind of drop you. And then you have these debuts coming in who are all potential, so they're making these wild bids on them. And then if that doesn't pan out, they drop you. So it's a little bit more frustrating to kind of stay in the game, but I think all you can do is stay in the game.
Well, I know it is, but I guess that comes back down to the decision. Like, I think that you have to know what the business is when you get into it. You know, you kind of have to take away like the dreamy, star-eyed look at publishing, you know, unidealize it and like really wrap your arms around like the cold, hard truth of where we're at and what it is and decide, is this something you want to do? And if it is, then the only thing you can do is just do it. You just
Fair
have to do
enough.
it and get better at it and just run your race no matter how hard it is. I know it's not an answer that anyone likes, but I firmly believe that that's like the only thing you can do.
There is no silver bullet. Oh, it's just like the rest of my life.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right. I guess with that, JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Ariel Sullivan on. Ariel grew up a military brat, moving every 2 or 3 years. As a perpetual new kid, she observed the world basically as an outsider and often found herself lost in books. She's here to tell us all about her latest novel called Conform. It's the first novel from Jenna Bush Hager's latest venture called A Thousand Voices. Here she is, Ariel Sullivan.
Okay, Ariel Sullivan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so we're geared to writers, so we always like to start by asking about how you got started in this crazy business of writing and publishing. How did you get your start?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really a childhood dream for me. I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't want to be a writer. Around, you know, I think I was like 8, I picked up the book, The Phantom Tollbooth, and I remember finishing it and being so enamored with this idea. All I wanted to do was to tell stories and to bring that to other people. And, you know, it took a long time, obviously in my 30s now, to get it done. But that's really what kind of gave that life. And it only grew as I read other stories, whether it was Harry Potter, or I mean, I even read the Twilight, you know, series, whatever it was. I was just so into the fact that people took this. And then I started researching different authors' motivation and why they were writing. And so much of it seemed to be rooted in them, you know, transmuting something they had dealt with in their own life and wanting to bring it to others. And I think that's such a special power. So that is something that I have always wanted to do. And I'm so thrilled that I'm finally doing it published.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have your debut novel coming out, Conform, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Had you written other novels that may not yet be published before that, or was this kind of your first one?
This was my first one to completion. I have a few others that I've dabbled with when I was younger. You know, I wrote one when I was a teen, very teen angst, very boy liked girl, girl like boy type situation. Nothing I've ever written was something where I wanted to take it to someone else until this one. And I was about 3/4 of the way done. And I was like, wait, this is actually something. So
nice. So this was the first one you actually tried to get published then.
Yes.
Excellent. And yeah, and it's getting published in a big way. So that's amazing. Were you just focusing on that novel at that time you were writing it, or were you working another job? What was your daily life sort of looking like?
So I was a stay-at-home mom, which I think is not always appreciated for the amount of work it is. When I started writing Conform, my sons, who are now 10 and 6, were less than 1 and 4. And we were in the middle of COVID as well. So we were home all the time together, which was very challenging while starting to write this. However, now it feels like it's something that was a blessing because I learned to write in very chaotic situations. My ritual is very simple. I just need the right song really loud in headphones. And I'm now a sprint writer. So I have written, in school pickup lines, nap times. So yeah, it was very hard to juggle, but now it's made it very easy to keep going.
That's fantastic. I think, there's a lot of us that get started when we're at home with kids, and there it's busy, but sometimes it's kind of not cognitively very challenging, so we need something else to do. So that's
Yeah.
great. Yeah. And does the right song always change, or is there one song?
No, it changes. So I listen to the same song on repeat until I'm done with the scene.
Oh.
And the song changes based on what scene I'm writing. Sometimes I will hear a song on, Spotify or Pandora or the radio, and it will inspire a scene that I can see in my head. And then, much to the dismay of my husband, I will then listen to that song on repeat until I get the scene out.
Oh, that's very cool. I like that a lot. I know people have playlists or certain styles of music, words, not words, but one song for a scene. I don't know that I've heard that before, so I'm curious if other people do that. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, I would love to hear it because it's a strange thing. And then once that scene is done, I almost can't stand the song for a while.
Yeah.
And so I have to like tuck it away and like take a break and then I'll come back to it later. But yeah, I am building a playlist for Conform just for fun. But it's my number one ritual and the only thing that really matters to me while writing.
Yeah, I love that. I do that too. Sometimes white noise, sometimes music, depending what I'm doing. So it's
Yeah.
very helpful to stay focused, especially when you don't have a lot of time, like when you're writing in chaos, right?
Yeah, and it feels like it almost quiets that internal chatter a little bit. And so the subconscious thoughts change for me when I put the music on. And then I researched it too and found out like it pulls on your limbic system in the brain, and that's where you store a lot of emotion. And that emotion, like they say, that music can help you tap into that.
Yeah.
And so I find that very interesting that it's kind of all tied together. But for me, the music makes it very meditative and quiets all the chatter.
Yeah. I love that. Okay. So you've got this first book you've completed. You know it's something. How did you go about trying to get it published? Did you find an agent? What did that journey look like for you?
I think it looks probably like most writers. I went to Google and finding literary agents and, fumbled my way through that. I sent it out. I like finished the book. I didn't really edit it because I was new to this whole thing. So I gave this unedited book out into the world, this manuscript, and got rejected by all of them. So I went back, I edited, and then I tried it again. And I was going through my second round of querying agents and fielding rejections. And then the Jenna piece came into it because her youngest son and my youngest son were in the same class. They
Okay.
had been in the same class like 2 years in a row. We'd seen each other at events. And then our sons got very close, and she invited my youngest son George over for a play date. And I lost track of time writing, and I told her that. And when I got there, she kindly, asked me what I was writing. It led into a whole conversation. I explained the world that I was trying to create, and she very kindly was like, I would love to read it. And I thought she was just being nice.
Nice, yeah.
And then she followed up on it and I sent it to her. And I had just gotten another rejection when she texted me and she said, wait, I think this is really something. Like, I think I have a plan for this. And it kind of, totally changed directions from
Wow.
there. So it was very unusual, but
Yeah, unusual,
great.
but not that unusual. Like personal connections are how a lot of people find their first publishing. So that's pretty serendipitous. That's pretty awesome.
Yes.
So I'm curious how that looked then, because usually, you get the agent and they might do a little bit of editorial work on it. So what did that look like for you? Did the agent come after? Did editorial work come after? Or what was that process like being the debut
Yes.
for Jenna's new book imprint? Thousand
Well, you
Voices.
know,
I want to hear all of that.
she was like very honest with me. She's like, "Hey, I have this idea. I'm trying to make it happen. You know, this is how I see it going." So she put me in contact with my wonderful agent at UTA. And then, you know, I did some editorial work with my agent on Conform. And then we had another very honest conversation of like, "Hey, do we want to go in on this together as the debut? Like, we're going to obviously have to go in on the publishing, you know, and all that, and be in line with all the different deals for starting her imprint and this book." And so we both agreed, and we had a lot of very great, honest conversations, and we went into it and ended up, you know, at Penguin Random House, which was phenomenal. But it was a collective group, which I felt very interesting because I've everything I'd read is it's a very difficult, sometimes lonely situation to get the book published, and mine had started that way and then just morphed into this, and I'm beyond flattered and honored to be her first debut novel, and she's got some other really great ones coming along too.
That's wonderful. So you were in kind of on the ground floor as this was being built and were able to offer suggestions and be a part of the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, suggestions in the sense of like what I like meshed well in terms of like the editors and stuff, but her entity is completely, you know, her own, and that's something that like I've always respected with her is because we did go in so early is, you know, she had her side and I had mine, and we made it work for both parties, and it was great, and
Well, that's
I'm
great.
thrilled.
So let's talk about the book now, Conform.
Okay.
What was the inspiration? Why did you want to write this book?
So this book actually came from a pretty dark time in my life. Like I'd mentioned, my youngest was under a year, and I had gone through fertility struggles between my two kids, and I finally got pregnant, and I had this wonderful, healthy baby boy, and you know, life sometimes isn't fair, and I got hit with some terrible, terrible postpartum depression. It was a very dark and lonely time for me, and I really felt like I kind of, you know, hit a rock bottom in my life, and it didn't help. And also was, you know, very unfortunate that the whole world was kind of going through that as well, because my son was 6 months old when everything shut down for COVID. And so I think the loneliness I was feeling was also felt, you know, kind of worldwide, and everything was very dark. We all didn't know what was happening in those early days. And it kind of left me in this place where I didn't have a reason not to write anymore. And then the inspiration for the story came after one of those really fun, you know, text message chains where somebody tests positive, and now we all have to track and find out if you were with them. And my husband and I were talking late at night about it, and I was like, I don't think we're at risk. And I made the joke, you know, one of these days we're just going to have like a chip and our wrist that just gives us all our health stuff all the time, because we were all so obsessed with, you know, our pulse ox, and everybody was trying to make sure they were as healthy as possible. So I said that, we joked, we went to bed. I woke up with my son at, you know, 2 in the morning to do a nighttime feed, put him back to sleep. And as I was, you know, feeding him, all I could think about was this comment I made. And I was like, what if there was this world where your health was your currency? What if your genes were what made you have, you know, your job or your life? And I didn't go back to bed after I put my son to sleep, and I started forming this plan. So it all came kind of from a really sad time, but it's created something really beautiful in my life.
And you just kind of got that what if, and it got snowballing, and now you've got a
And
whole book.
now I've got a whole book. I've got a trilogy of trilogies. So.
And that's interesting. You're talking about it was kind of a dark time. We were all, cooped up at home, and I noticed a few times in the books it talks about th something like you thought there was a good guy and a bad guy, didn't you? Was that kind of that morally grayness of the characters, was that also, you think, inspired by that time? Or what interests you
I
about writing
do.
that?
I do. I have always been infatuated with the gray in stories. I think the black and white can be two polar opposite, and I think there's room for a discussion in the middle. And, you know, during COVID, everybody felt very differently on social distancing, on vaccines. There were so many things that felt very isolating. People were in one or the other. And so I think that really inspired this idea of when I split the society up of having, one side that seemed very clearly, in the clouds and had one point of view and one beneath a different point of view. And then I threw in the middle this group of minor defects that were kind of in the gray. They didn't have all the knowledge. And, Emmeline really, she has this thirst for knowledge that definitely I think came from that time where we were all looking to understand.
I can see it. There was literally one group living in bubbles. So
Yeah.
I can see that. And then do you think I know you grew up moving around a lot. Do you think that influences your writing at all?
Yeah, I do. I think whether we like it as or not as writers, I think your personal lived experiences will come out in your novel. Sometimes in the best ways, I've learned a lot about myself in writing. Sometimes in ways where you're like you don't love as much. But I think moving every 2 years, I went to a different school every 2 years. And so I think it's changed the way I write in the sense of I'm not afraid of a tragic ending or leaving unanswered questions or, pulling the ripcord on something where people want it wrapped up and neat. Because in my life, that was it. There were so many forced goodbyes, friendships that never were. And so I think that comes out in my writing in the sense that I'm okay if you're a little frustrated and not understanding everything right away, because that was a prevailing feeling I had as a child and into young adult.
That's so interesting. So when you're doing this, this is more fantasy. Did you have to do any research at all? Or is it all kind of just more organic?
There's a lot of aspects that are organic. I didn't want to go too heavy science fiction, but I did research, genetics. I also researched, in the book it says that there was, a nuclear war that, wiped out humanity for the most part. So I did some research on, what a nuclear winter might or might not happen, what it would look like, how long it would take for people to rebuild. So there was light research, but I did keep it lighter. I think that was also due to the time I was writing in when it was, COVID. I wanted this to be heavy, but a good escape. And I think sometimes when you go too into the weeds, it can be hard on a reader. So I wanted to really like embody that escapism within the novel.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there anything kind of interesting or weird that you learned about nuclear winters or genetics while you were down those Google rabbit holes?
I wouldn't say weird necessarily. I mean, yes, the rabbit holes are terrifying, and the Reddit rabbit holes for nuclear warfare. Found a lot of doomsday preppers who had a lot of stuff ready to go, which I found very intriguing. And then also was like, am I not prepared enough for something I don't know? But as far as the genetics, I found it very validating and going through a lot of it because when I was in my fertility struggles, it was 4 years. I had multiple losses, and we were desperate to figure out what was going on. And so I did genetic testing on myself. And at the time, I wasn't really interested in what the genetic testing said. I was just interested in an answer, like, tell me why this isn't happening. So it was really neat as I started to research the genetics. I went back, I pulled my own stuff out, and I like got to look through it. And now on the other side of it with a healthy child, and I looked through it. And so I found that personally, like a very validating experience.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of that in the book too.
Yeah,
Fertility.
there is.
That's very interesting. So now you're moving towards releasing your book out into the world. I believe this episode airs on your release date.
Oh,
Has there
wow.
been anything you've had to do after the book has been completed in terms of marketing publicity that's been interesting or surprising to you?
I think just the amount I find surprising. As a writer, I'm so used to being behind a screen and with fictional characters that I made up in my own head. And it's very different to step out. And then it's thrilling to talk about this world that I am so passionate about and that I, have a very big plan for. So it's great to talk about, but it is very strange because writing is such a, I don't want to call it lonely, but you do a lot of stuff alone. And then all of a sudden it switches, and now it's like, well, no, now go talk to this person, go see this. And so it's very interesting to see the social aspect of being an author that I just hadn't anticipated.
Yeah, and how's that been? Has it been okay for you to
It's been all right. I mean, it's been all right. It's I've got a wonderful team. I love marketing and my publicity, like my publicist at Penguin Random House. They're phenomenal. They, hold my hand through everything as I, stumble around. But I think at the end of the day, as a writer, my favorite thing to do is to, tuck back into the world and keep writing. So it's fun. I'm excited to do it. It's just, I'll always get more of a high from being with my characters.
Yeah. So speaking of, you said you have big plans
I
for this
do.
world. I saw in your end notes you're planning 8 books. Is that correct?
Nine. It's a
Nine
trilogy
books.
of trilogies. The second one, actually, Jenna just announced Beneath, and I'm doing something a little unconventional, and it's the prequel.
Okay. I saw that. Yeah,
So,
I saw that.
yeah, so I'm taking the reader back to when the world actually fell. And so, a lot of the questions that stay open and conform, you get to find out within this. And I've always been infatuated with the idea that history always repeats itself. Why is that? What are the themes? And so these two novels are 200 years apart and they like interweave together. And so I'm going to yo-yo the reader back and forth between the two. And I know I leave with a gnarly like cliffhanger at the end of Conform. I promise that one will come. The next one will come soon. But yeah, so I'm taking the reader into Beneath and that one is done and it'll be out in March. And I'm just hoping that readers are okay with going on a little bit of a, circuitous route to get to the ending.
Very interesting. So 9 books. Did you have that in the back of your mind as you were writing book one, or did that kind of come later? Because you do le end on a cliffhanger, so I feel like you probably had more in mind than where book one ended.
Yeah, so when I started Conform in the very, very beginning, that night, it was going to be a one and done book. That was my thought because I mean it was already a daunting experience to write a book. Like it's there's a reason I hadn't finished one. I'd come up with a lot of excuses not to. So, I was like, I'm going to write this one book. I'll get it done and I'll figure out what happens next. And I got about 4 to 5 chapters in, a couple months of writing, and I was like, as I was, crafting the world and building it, and I was like, wait, there's more to this. And so it's like, okay, it's going to be a trilogy. And I stopped writing. I mapped out the trilogy and I was like, done. And then I was writing more and I was answering questions as to why the world operated the way it did. And I was like, okay, this is a crazy idea. But I'm gonna write more. So I mapped out the next three for a trilogy. And then the other trilogy is purely a side character story that people have told me they're in love with. And
Oh,
I am
neat.
also in love with. So that one will come later down the road. But yeah, so it's 9 books in total. And it sounds insane. But Jenna was actually the first person I pitched that to, that it was actually going to be nine.
Yeah.
Before that, I had told everybody it's going to be a trilogy. Like every single query letter I sent, it was like three. Because I just thought, who was going to take a risk on a debut author saying, hey, I've never written anything, I've never been published, and I want to write nine?
Yeah.
And so when I was talking to her about it, it was actually, as silly as it is, it was my New Year's resolution to talk about the fact that I was writing to people. And I said it, and to this day, she's like, you had such an intricate plan that it was so hard to ignore. And so I realized that I probably shouldn't have sold myself short,
Yeah.
even being a debut author. It's okay to, shoot for the stars and see what happens.
Yeah, I love that because so many of us are introverted. Sometimes we're not comfortable talking about our writing, doing the marketing, doing the PR. Sometimes we have to talk ourselves into doing it. So I love that that was your New Year's resolution and you talked about your book. I should do more of that.
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, it's one of those things like I am very introverted. I don't want to always talk. I still have to this day people I'm doing something for my son's school because they do a book fair every year. And the wonderful woman running it, asked me to volunteer. And I was like, of course. And I just did a class coffee and I had multiple friends of mine who I'm close with come up and be like, I didn't even know you wrote.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to get, like, sometimes you are the person in your own way, especially when we are typically people who want to hide away and be alone. So it's very hard, but I would encourage everybody to market your book and talk about it because
Yes.
you never know where a conversation's going to go.
No, and then you end up creating your own genre. What are we calling this? Dystomance? What?
They're coining it dystomance. You
Dystomance.
know, romanticy was such a big hit. We're now taking it into a dystopian,
Yeah.
which they're, conflicting genres, but we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I think it's really fun. I'm starting to see more genre mashups, and I think it's great to get things that are a little bit different. So,
Yeah. Why
okay.
stay, in the lines?
Yeah, 9 books
Yeah.
in Dystomance. Do you think you'll stay in the fantasy genre, like for your career, or do you think you might write outside of that?
I love a challenge, so I'll
Yeah.
probably try to like get myself out of it. I have an idea for a much quieter, softer literary book that's been on
Ooh.
my mind for years. So I think now that once I get this all done, and I think I'll feel more daring to take a swing at that. But there's also another fantasy series that I've worked on and off over the years that I might revisit, but that one's full magic.
Okay.
So we'll see. I don't know. I hate keeping myself, boxed in. I also love poetry. I've written poetry my whole life, and so maybe one day I will. I always joke I'm going to write one called "In My Notes" because most of my poetry is in my phone notes. So we'll see. I don't know. I like to keep it fun and see whatever like I'm inspired by at the moment.
Oh, that's great. I love that. So, yeah,
Yeah.
can't wait to see how that all goes and what you come out with next. So we'll keep an eye out on that.
Thanks.
And just as we're wrapping up, we have one question we always like to ask. If you could
Yeah.
offer advice to newer or aspiring writers, what would you say to them?
Oh man. I mean, there's so many things you could say. I'll say the thing that got me out of my own way is that every great story has already been told, which sounds very disheartening. But it was like the idea that, you wanted forbidden love. You could look at, Romeo and Juliet, Wuthering Heights. You'd go even further back. We go to Greek mythology with like Hades and Persephone. You do enemies to lovers and do like Pride and Prejudice. Dystopian's been done. Everything's been done, and yet readers are still reading the stories. And so I stopped putting this pressure on myself that I had to reinvent the wheel or do something that's never been done. And I realized along the line that like the only thing that made my story different than everybody else's is that I'm the one writing it.
Yeah.
And when you make yourself the element that people can't, duplicate, like all of a sudden you have all this power. And so it really, I stopped stressing that it needed to be this out of the park like hit. It was just me writing what I always wanted to, knowing that the pressure was off, and it changed everything for me.
Yeah, that is such fantastic advice. No one has your voice or your perspective. So that's what you're bringing to the story. That's new. That's wonderful.
Yeah,
Okay.
that and write. I mean, that sounds like redundant, but write what you don't want to write. I figured I've found in my experience that is the thing that I started this by saying I'm going to write 100 words a day and see what happens. And even on the days I don't want to write, I still will open my computer and write just 100 words because it just keeps you going.
Okay, so I know we've talked about before listening to music and white noise and all of that when we're writing. What do you think about listening to the same song over and over while you're writing a scene? Does that appeal to you? Why or why not?
That is madness. And honestly, it reminded me of a conversation that I had with Koontz a few years back. I forget what book it was he had coming out, but they sent him 400,000 book plates to sign.
Yeah.
And it took him a little over 2 weeks to sign all these book plates, so he initially started off just, with like a random playlist of stuff. Then he honed in on Paul Simon, and then he hauled in, he kind of dialed it back, and he was listening to just the Graceland album by Paul Simon. And then at one point he was just listening to one song off the Graceland album over and over and over again. And it was like this complete descent into madness that was going
Yeah.
on as he signed all these. That's what it feels like to me.
I've sort of accidentally done that.
I think it depends on the song. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it honestly does. Like, I don't, because I know plenty of people that do that. Like, the song can set the mood. That mood sets the chapter. So
Yeah.
it makes perfect sense.
I can't do this anymore. But when I was in my like 20s and even a little bit into my 30s, while I was writing, I would play things like one thing that got played over and over again was all the behind the scenes DVDs for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the extended edition stuff. Because I had watched and listened to that so many times, it was just noise. And so I could sit, it was comforting. Like it was like, I wasn't alone. There was other, and I guess it's a little bit like sitting in a, a cafe or something and trying to write with a bunch of chatties all around you, I guess. But I can't do it anymore. Now it distracts me and I don't know why.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, I like to listen to specific genres of music for different characters in different books. But I was like, man, this would, if it was one song over and over, I think I would be motivated to write that scene faster.
Yeah, Anna got a DeVita. I just put it on repeat and just write.
I was saying when you were talking about soundtracks, I guess I could do that, with like a musical score, whether it's classical, because those don't have lyrics, and so it's very like, those
Yeah.
like the swells of the music and all that. Like, I could see listening to that over and over again because it does like evoke a certain feeling. So if you're trying to like stay tapped into an emotion, I think that could work well. I don't know if I've ever intentionally done that though. I've unintentionally listened to the same song over and over and over
Yeah,
again,
yeah.
but that's a different story.
So it's interesting because I don't really listen to something. I occasionally I'll put in like a cinematic playlist or something, but not so that it doesn't inform what I'm writing per se, I've noticed. Instead, it's more of a what sort of mood do I want to be in as a writer? And so a lot of times I'll do like lo-fi or jazz or blues or depending on the mood I want to be in. And so I'll get a thread of music going that way.
But
So
is the mood you want to be in
it
tied in
doesn't
some
tie
way
into the
to what
story.
you're writing? Like, so if
Yeah,
you're
no.
sad, you can't write like a happy, upbeat scene.
Oh, I don't have emotions, so it works out
Oh,
fine.
God, Kevin. We're all gonna put in for a therapist for Christmas. That's what we're gonna do.
My cold robotic heart doesn't allow for what you
I
humans
don't
call an
believe that.
emotion.
Oh,
Now,
speaking
I
of.
don't know. I don't have I don't know if I'm disconnected from something. I don't know, but I can write one emotion while feeling another. So,
That's
I don't
weird
know. Yeah.
for me. That's weird.
That's probably indicative of me being psychotic or something. So,
If
we'll get some
there are any
letters.
practicing psychiatrists listening, please let us
Please
know
let
what's
us
wrong
know.
with
I
Kevin.
am what one calls neurodivergent. It's a
Oh,
common theme on the show.
okay, so you said Christmas, and afterwards comes New Year's. So I loved that Ariel's New Year's resolution was to talk about her writing. I always feel like super
Oh,
awkward
yeah.
talking to people about writing, and I want to know, how do you bring it up to people who are just in your life and not in your writing life, if that makes sense? Or do you bring it up?
I was going to
I
say,
don't.
I do podcasts. So.
I get like it's very weird for me. Like we get a lot of work done around the house, and a lot of times contractors will show up and like they'll bring it up, and I'm guessing that like, they just Google me, and they see my signature and my emails or something like that. But like they come and like I can always tell when they've done it, because like there's just something about the way they look at me or the way they speak that's just different than somebody who's just meeting me off the street who has no idea, and it creates this awkward tenseness. And then I feel like I have to give them a book, so I've got to find a book that's signed. So yes, it's an odd thing, but I think we all need to get better at talking about it, and not only with people like on interviews and those types of situations, but just in social stuff, because I think a lot of people just don't understand. Like they see the perfect author in a movie or a TV show, and that's
Yeah.
their understanding of what our lives are, and
Yeah.
that's couldn't be further
I
from the
do
truth.
nothing to dissuade them from that opinion. And so there's two things. There's two things you can always count
You
on me.
invite them to your cabin.
Oh yeah. I tell them, when the next time you're in, the north, come on over. So
bring a ribbon for
there's
the
two
typewriter.
things I will always do. I will always work in that I'm an author, always. Any conversation I ever have, ask my wife. Sometimes in the middle of our conversations, I just remind her gently, I'm a writer. And the other is karaoke. So those two things you can always count on Kevin for. And sometimes I combine those two things.
I bet you do.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Don't know. I'll say, like, if people ask, what do? I usually just say, like, oh, I'm a writer. I do a lot of freelance stuff. If they ask, I'll talk about,
Do
like,
you downplay it like that? Do you say, oh, I'm a writer? Do you downplay it?
Yeah, because what I've noticed is, like, first of all, no one knows what that means. And then they'll be like, oh, what books have you written? And then you have to, like, go into this whole, like, I've written
Yeah.
several, but oh, where can I buy it? Well, you can't. Like, oh, when is it coming out? Maybe never. And, like,
And I always
that's
get the oh, is it anything is I say, I'm a writer. Oh, anything I've read? How would I know what you've Yes. You know that book Da Vinci Code? That's me.
I know. I guess it just gets like, I guess I've just noticed that people usually have like this weird, like they're just at a certain point, like your answers just get bizarre and then like they're
Yeah.
confused and you're just like, can we just, and so I've learned like, oh, I'm a freelance writer, because at least, if they Google that, there's like a bunch of freelance stuff up, and then that feels like it kind of puts a nice button on the conversation and I don't have to get into the whole like,
Yeah.
let me tell you about the woes of traditional publishing.
Yeah. I had this experience. See, I was trying. She inspired me. So last week, I emailed three boxes of books to go to Author Nation, and I had to bring them across the border from Ontario over to Michigan to mail
Yeah.
them. And so I had three sealed boxes, and I had one signed copy out, going, oh, if the border guard asks me about it, I'll give it to him. And I'm like, I had three boxes of books. And he's like, go. I'm like, oh man, I didn't even get to talk about it. He didn't care.
Well, the flip
That's
side of that is
funny.
you're smuggling contraband and you just try to bribe the border guy.
Yeah.
I know.
You catch somebody in the wrong mood, that could be a problem.
I guess, well, you could open the boxes if he wants to. That's his right.
Come
But I
on.
was just going to be
Christine,
nice and give him
okay,
a book, but he did not give a crap. He was just like, go.
that's because you're this innocent ball of sunshine. Like, Christine could like get busted for, bribing a border guard, and they would still just be like, she's fine. She didn't know what she was doing. Just let her go.
I know. I was so excited. I went into the post office and I had like the copy in my backpack because I'm like, it's media mail. And the post office guy didn't care. So I'm like, fine, nobody's getting this book. I'm just gonna keep it.
You should have put it somewhere random. Have you seen that company that does that? They're called like Book Fairies, and they have like this international thing, and you can sign up and like put these stickers in a book, and just leave them in random places. And they have like a social media site because they're supposed to find the book and then say what book they found where. And it's
That's
like,
cool.
yeah, they'll find them. Emma Watson did a whole thing where she hid a bunch of books around London and like in random places for people to find. I think that's so fun.
That's very fun. Yeah.
That's
All right.
cool.
So in Vegas, we should hide a bunch of books.
I like it. Let's get stickers and people can post on social media where they found books. I love it.
Yeah.
All right. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got A.G. Riddle coming on. Riddle spent 10 years starting and running internet companies before retiring just to focus on his true passion, which was writing. He's the author of 13 novels and sold over 6 million copies worldwide in 20 languages. A.G. Riddle.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.